In this episode, I talk with Robert Cuffey, one of the organizers of this movement in New York City, confronting one of the most powerful police departments, not only in the US, but the world. Cuffey is a member of the organizing committee of the New York City Afro-Socialist Caucus of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, a member of the organizing committee of the New York City Labor Branch, and a longtime rank and file member of Social Services Employees Union Local 371. He also happens to be the co-founder of the Socialist Workers Alliance in Guyana. And most directly relevant to our conversation here, he's an organizer with the People's Strike Network, which is the New York City organization of the Fight for Our Lives Coalition. In the first part of this conversation, we discussed the broad political and historical context of the current protests in New York. In this second part, we talk about the nitty-gritty of the defund demand in the specific context of the NYPD, the New York Police Department. The mayor of New York City has declared his willingness to cut $1 billion off the $6 billion budget for the NYPD, though this would be a significant cut. Exactly how it's done matters, and whether it happens at all remains to be seen. The NYPD is a large political economy all by itself, with more than 55,000 unionized employees, including 36,000 police officers, fewer than half of whom are actually white. Its budget is bigger than the GDP of some African countries. And after 9/11, it has developed surveillance and intelligence capacities to rival those of some wealthy countries. For example, the department sends its own anti-terrorism agents to countries like Afghanistan. We pick up where we left off in part one. You were very clear and sharp about the dangers of the demands for defunding police becoming a squabble over line items in city budgets, among groups of people who are, I'm excluding the police, but in general, the public sector employees, all being pitted against one another. So how do we get out of this this trap?
I think we need an actual class-wide struggle. And one of the things about this period of American history, this post-war boom where America, where the United States was able to build up a real middle class, is that it blunted class consciousness to the point that many working class people don't consider themselves working class, right? And the United States doesn't even have the instruments of working class organization that Western European countries do, or that Canada or Mexico do, where they have like a reform party of the working class, like Canada's New Democratic Party or the British Labour Party. So one of our tasks is to begin to build such an organization. I think you begin by propagandizing for it, by saying it's a good idea, meeting with people and having discussion groups. But there's also a moment we have here where we can go beyond propaganda to agitation, right? That we can tell people strategically, we need to build towards a mass strike, a mass movement that says, unless these demands are won, we as working people will use the most valuable tool we have, the most powerful thing we have under capitalism. We will stop working. Now, this may seem like a fanciful dream for people because, for one thing, there's not, to my memory, ever been a nationwide general strike in the United States. And they're even hard to pull off in a place like New York City that's like broken up into three or four different islands and a piece of the mainland. But if you scale down from that, the question is, okay, what is concrete and what is actionable? Okay, on June 30th, the New York City Council is going to vote on a budget. And in this budget is where they're trying to satiate the demands of the protest. The governor has literally come out and said, you got what you want, you've been heard, you asked for reform, go home now. The mayor has pledged to cut $600 million from the city's budget. The Speaker of the City Council, Corey Johnson, who's positioning himself to run for mayor, understands that the movement finds de Blasio to be talking out of both sides of his mouth and to, as a lame duck politician, not really have that much baggage when he goes along with these things. So the Speaker of the City Council, Corey Johnson, has said, we will cut $1 billion over one fiscal year. And there's another proposal to cut $1 billion over 4 years.
And $1 billion is significant, right? That's like a good...
It's significant insofar every time it's talked about, it kind of makes the cops angry.
Yeah.
Right? But meaningfully, we haven't heard how these cuts will stop the police's ability to kill people with impunity. Mm. And we haven't heard how these cuts will actually make the cops hurt, right? Will any cops take home any less money? So if you look deep into the proposals are like, okay, we're going to cut overtime. We're going to shift this to that. And there's no mechanisms built into any of these bills that say, for example, that civilian members of the police department will be spared cuts. Mm-hmm. There's one proposal from the DC 37 Union Federation that the cops who do clerical work be replaced with civilian employees, and that they be, you know, led into the union, and that this will help to build up the working class. But no one asks the question of, well, does that mean we have 500 more cops on the street? Mm. You see, so like the level of interrogation and reality testing and critical analysis of these demands is the way in which the theory and the organization and the activism meet. And if we charge ahead with these demands in an empty fashion without grounding them to reality, we run the danger of letting the movement be co-opted. So like I went to a defund the police second line march on Saturday in Manhattan, and it was one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever been a part of. It was people dressed in white and red following a band singing things like defund the police. We want abolition. And we went to the speaker's house, and we very theatrically and beautifully laid flowers at an altar for the people who passed away outside of his house. And we called on him to defund the police. And one of the lines was, we won $1 billion. I'm sorry, y'all have to hear me sing. But, you know.
No, it's great.
When it came to the speeches, almost every speaker said $1 billion was not enough. And Miriam Kaba has written as much in the New York Times in an op-ed where she said, defund the police by 50%. And I think that really challenges the notion of who the police are and what they do in our society, that we could reduce them by half and still get along. And it shows the opposite of what the capitalist system is built on. The capitalist system is built on this unending quest for profit. Those of us who want a socialist world, you want a radical world. If you just want a good world, you realize that the world has to be built around the needs of people, right? And in addressing these needs, fundamentally, we do not need a body alienated from us like the police. We need us. So like one of the main slogans in our protest is, who keeps us safe? We keep us safe, right? Like at my job, when the city of New York, who's my employer, failed to give me adequate personal protective equipment, I was able to reach out to a mutual aid network of just talented people who were sewing masks and giving to essential workers.
And so what was your job? What were you doing?
I'm a casework supervisor in child welfare with the city's administration for children's services.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that. So, you know, part of it is that our job includes house-to-house visits, home visits. So we could be vectors for the transmission of COVID-19. Mm. And our directors would just look at us in the face at the beginning of this and say, we don't have anything. You know what they gave us? They gave us expired hand sanitizer. Mm. But we were able to source masks for ourselves as workers, relying on a mutual aid network of other people. And this, in many ways, presages, right, like what an actual socialist society could be once you put the needs of people first. It's like a very infamous story, for example, of the city's medical director who received a request from the NYPD for 500,000 masks. And she infamously only gave them about like 10,000 or something. And she said she has better things to do with them because the city's hospitals were being overwhelmed with COVID-19 and the hospital workers needed the personal protective equipment more so than the cops, who have the option to not go around harassing people. Right? So like this is the irrationality of capitalism, right? Like, so at my job, I actually got in trouble. I had a disciplinary hearing for, among other things, getting masks from my coworkers. When I asked the director at my job to coordinate the distribution of masks to various offices, since I was only one person, I got a bureaucratic rebuke about not using the proper forms, about reaching out on my own. And eventually I had to sit down with management and my union rep to allegedly to address concerns that I allegedly broke the ranks of chain of command because I spoke to a journalist about what was happening. This is the sense our system makes, which is very little. So when you say defund the police, you're saying, wow, you're raising the question. We can live in a society where this brutality and murdering by this special armed body of men with a monopoly on force that only they can have guns, and they just use it on unarmed people, half of them could be gone and we're still here. And it's in that sense, things like defund the police, abolish the police, disarm and dismantle the police are what you could call transitional demands, insofar as they point to the future and they can't necessarily be achieved without a linked revolutionary unending struggle that says this is our demand. And it's transitional because it shows people and it lets them to begin the process of their own consciousness and self-actualization to ask the question and answer the question about capitalism or socialism. Because within the left, we have a lot of meaningful debates, many of which I'm part of myself, about reform or revolution, right? Yeah. But for everyday people, they're not there yet. They're still questioning the validity of this system and how far they have to go against it. And to like paraphrase Walter Rodney, we as socialists, we can preach, you know?
Yeah.
We can give an edict of good faith that it's socialism that's the only solution. But at the end of the day, people have to ask for themselves. As Rodney says, you have to look and see where you are in society, who you are in society, where you came from, what your class origins are, what is your trajectory, where can you go, and more importantly, as Rodney says, where can you not go because of forces beyond your own control? And then you answer the question, capitalism or socialism. And then, you know, a similar process happens if you're answering the question, reform or revolution. But at the end of the day, like, leftists have a bad habit of really poor pedagogy where we're like, teaching people like it's a British classroom in the 19th century where we're lecturing instead of like digging in more to like a critical pedagogy of like a Walter Rodney grounding or a Paulo Freire, where you understand that the learning process is mutual. And, you know, like the socialist left has to like hold up a mirror to say, hey, we're the mostly educated part of the working class, parts of the precariat that's been thumped down into the working class, and parts of the middle class. How do we ground with the real working class? How do we, like in New York City DSA, for example, the question would be, how do we build relationships with people who live in public housing? Because the city is the largest landlord in New York City because NYCHA houses more people than any other single entity. Yet it is $10 billion behind on capital improvements. So the projects are run down. People live with holes in their ceilings and all these things. Yet these are the people who put themselves on the front line of the movement. So it's a missed opportunity that we, and I say we, because this is a self-criticism, right? Like I haven't grounded with the NYCHA tenants myself, even though we're taking small steps in that direction. But imagine if there was a Democratic Socialist of America, New York City public housing working group, where we could have responded to the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on public housing as well as the disproportionate impact of the enforcing of social distancing measures by NYPD, where we could have been when the rebellion against George Floyd broke out, right?
Yeah, I mean, do you think it's too late to do that? Seems like, you know, the problems are still there, and now that people are coming out, and isn't it possible now to form that group?
So this is a moment of opportunity, and I can say, for example, that the DSA tonight at 7 p.m. will be holding a call to build in this city with as many people as possible one mass march, right? That will happen on the day, on the day of, or the day before the city council vote on the budget, because we've been having a lot of side actions. You know, we've been having like the second line march. We haven't built a mass rally similar to, like, let's say in 2006, what the immigrants' rights rally looked like here, or what maybe what the women's march looked like in DC. That's not been done, but it's in the works, and that's promising. And also, like, so this, I'm also working because I live in one of these neglected parts of the city. I live in Cypress Hills, which is within Community Board 5, which is generally called East New York. And East New York is like, it's East New York because if you walk 5 blocks away from my house, you're in Queens. It's far from the city center, and it's one of the last places to be gentrified. As a result, public services here suck. The roads are terrible. We only have one or two trains that really roll through here. But also, we have this nexus called Broadway Junction that's like an entry point to East New York. And the state has plans to turn it into this state-of-the-art commercial hub, which will then bring a flood of gentrifiers into the neighborhood, displacing longtime residents. Given that the crisis of COVID-19 and the crisis of unemployment and the crisis of police brutality falls heaviest on people in my community, what we want to do is build a march here that foregrounds our community, because a lot of the marches in the city have been beautiful and excellent, but a great number of them have been disproportionately white. A great number of them have just been called by white people themselves. And what we want to do is build a coalition, an intentional coalition that foregrounds both Black leadership and Black participation. And we want to do this on July 4th weekend to repose Frederick Douglass's question of what to a slave is the 4th of July. Oh, right? Nice. Like, what to a Black person in the United States is the 4th of July, when George Floyd's life doesn't matter, when Breonna Taylor's life doesn't matter, Tony McDade, Rayshard Brooks, and I could literally take up the rest of your call saying these names.
Of course, yeah.
Right? Exactly, to answer your question, the opportunity in the moment is here to bridge these divides. But to bridge them, you have to first acknowledge them.
So there's so many directions we can go here. And, I want to ask you about, you're a rank and file union member, yourself. And so the question of deunionizing police kind of reducing the collective bargaining rights of police, which, is one demand that is sort of current these days. So I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about, this critique of social work that we've also heard now, that, the easy demand to, let's just have social workers. And since, you're a caseworker yourself.
Yesterday, yeah. Very interestingly, the rally that I spoke at Abolition Plaza, one of the people who went before me was a parents' rights advocate. And she was lacing into my agency and giving us the business, like a very general critique about the ways in which my agency ruins Black lives. And she is not wrong. I can tell you, for example, that even though Black children make up about 30% of the children in New York City, the number of children in foster care who are Black are 60%, right? So that's a huge disproportionality. But if we take it wider to the question of, like, social workers, cops out of schools, can the cops be replaced with social workers? Would the social workers just be nicer cops? Let's be clear. Who are in the schools. Are they cops? I would answer the question no, because I've been to a rally of this dissident union faction called the Union of Rank and File Educators, and they built this great march where Black parents and children spoke about their experiences and where the teachers spoke about the way they were cast aside. And one of the speakers said forthrightly, we do not need officers in our schools. We don't need police officers in our school. We need peace officers. And right then and there, if there was a DJ, they should have, like, you know, scratched the record and go, oh, wait. Because the NYPD school safety officers who are in the New York City public schools are peace officers. Mm-hmm. And what a peace officer means in New York State is that you go through a certain amount of training and background clearance, and the state empowers you to detain people. They don't empower you to be armed. They empower you to detain people, transport them to the nearest precinct, and have charges filed. Mm. So, for example, my agency has quote-unquote peace officers, and they call ACS police officers. And for the most part, they function as security in buildings. But in places like the ACS Children's Center, where I previously worked, where children who were removed from their parents are brought to stay until more permanent homes are found for them, if the children get into altercations with each other or with staff, then these peace officers are breaking things up, right? Mm. In schools, the NYPD school safety officers do the same thing. But again, they do so under the guise of peace officers. So again, this is like one of the ways in which you have to reality test, go back in history. What happened is in 1998, Mayor Giuliani, you know, and this is during the era of mass incarceration, where you can get away with almost anything police friendly, especially given what New York City looked like in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Giuliani moved the school security agents from under the DOE, the Department of Education, to the NYPD. So now that when they're hired, they're trained by the NYPD. So now, it to me, it's a very sensible demand to say, let them be trained in the core of social work. Mm. The same way I was. When I came to my agency, I came with a bachelor's in criminal justice. I knew nothing about child welfare, but I sat in a classroom for 2 months and I learned. I then went into the field as an apprentice worker and I learned. And then, and only then, was I permitted to do the job. And, you know, my supervisor helped me along the way. They taught me compassion and care. So if cops out the school means taking the cops under from taking the school safety officers from under the NYPD, not having them go through training where they see children adversarially, right?
Yeah.
Then, yes, more social workers. Also, very concretely, here's the thing. Not every New York City school has a social worker or even a guidance counselor assigned to them. These social workers work at multiple schools. So when someone raises a demand for more social workers, to me, to counterpose it and say, well, you know, are they just going to be doing the same type of monitoring of the cops? Maybe, but you have to dig down into your concrete, material, specific historical circumstances to answer the question. Mm. And in New York City, there's a shortage of social workers. There's an overabundance of peace officers. Yeah. It makes sense then to make a demand for social workers. Now, if the retraining of the peace officers is not enough, and there's a need to be more thoroughgoing, then say, yes, we keep us safe, and we don't need as many peace officers. But please remember, the peace officers are not unionized by the Police Benevolent Association, yeah, the school safety agents. They're not unionized by the Sergeant Benevolent Association, nor are they part of any distinct law enforcement body. They're unionized by the Teamsters. Now, this doesn't mean that school safety officers don't oftentimes have terrible attitudes towards the children with whom they work, and that they're are not responsible for enforcing the plantation-like discipline system within the Board of Education. But getting the cops out the schools alone, right, is not going to achieve the task of reforming the discipline system itself. We still have to be calling for things like taking away the ability of principals to unilaterally suspend children, especially when the suspensions themselves are racially biased and the behaviors of Black children that would be considered typical for white children are criminalized, that they have to do things like figure out how to put handcuffs on five-year-olds, right? Like, and this is where the critique of social workers filling in for cops comes around, because if you leave the same disciplinary structure in place, and instead of putting physical handcuffs on the child, you try to restrain them with a language of civility and bourgeois respectability, then yes, I get it. But part of it then like points to that the whole damn system has got to go, right? Because like one of the things the school system does, it generates the rhythms of my job as someone who works in child welfare. When school is out, oh, it's a breeze at my job because there's no one calling in reports. It's primarily schools that call in child welfare reports against families. And a disproportionate number of these reports are really just what you would call situations of poverty. The family is living in the house without electricity. Well, it's not that the family is living in the house without electricity and a caring neighbor is calling and the government is going and providing aid. No, if you call a child welfare, the state's child welfare hotline, it alleges that the parent is either neglecting or abusing the child, and the worker who's responding is responding with an investigation to see if these allegations are either substantiated or unsubstantiated. So I've literally had to explain to school officials before who said, oh, but I only called to help the family because the mother is doing everything they can, but the child just won't go to school. And I was like, let me explain how you've helped this person. Prior to this, they had no record with our system. Now, just by having this case, whether it's unfounded or not, or whether it's indicated against the parent, it will stay on the record for 7 years. I might be getting this number wrong, but for about 7 years after your youngest child turns 18. So if, for example, throughout your whole life, you just happen to keep having children, this record is accessible, right? Like, and it's there. If you wanted to become a teacher, for example, they have to do this background check on you and they'll see it there. So there's a way in which everything is interconnected and a way in which the fire lit by the George Floyd rebellion kind of illuminates the interconnectivity. And I think that's what we're seeing here. So I think as we go along these processes, we have to then push back. And in some ways, after digging down and understanding what we want for our demands, we have to expand them to say, okay, well, however the cuts are made, know this. We, the working people, will not have the budget balance on our backs, right? That if there's cuts being made from here and cuts being made from there, we want to question what the revenue stream is, what the funding source is, because it's already the case that the federal government is threatening not to fund New York. And, you know, you have to acknowledge the ways in which the federal government has agency over things that the city and the state does not. But at the end of the day, there's what I would call a silver bullet insofar as it can provide actual funding and it could put into the past this thing that there's only this amount of money to go around and bring to reality that, yes, there's only this amount of money to go around, but the political will of where the money is spent is determined by the class structure of our society. And nothing speaks better to that than the fact that in New York, we have a tax. We have a law called the stock transfer tax that's supposed to get a piece of the profit every time a stock is traded on Wall Street. But we do not enforce this law. We do not enforce this tax because of how friendly we want to be to Wall Street. But over the course of about four fiscal years, we could raise about $10 billion should we enforce this tax. And the conservative response is capital flight. You know, Wall Street's going to leave. But how realistic is this for Wall Street to leave New York?
Where will it go? You know?
Where will it go? And if it does go, how bad will it be? Because one of the things that Wall Street and the billionaires and millionaires in this city do is further the crisis of housing. Because one of the things they do is they push up the median income in the city so high that if I live here in East New York, Brooklyn, and I go to apply for quote-unquote affordable housing, I won't be able to afford it because they'll say the median income of the average New Yorker is XYZ, not taking into consideration the area median income of people who live in the most dispossessed parts of the city with concentrated poverty. Yet, we give tax breaks to real estate developers to keep on building. And this is the legacy of the so-called progressive mayor de Blasio, right? That he's entered into these 70-30 partnerships with developers where they get tax breaks for building. They're allowed to keep 70% of the apartments market rate, make 30% of the apartments affordable. But that affordability, and we're not on video, needs to be an uplifted quote. Because there's a question, who can actually afford these buildings? Then we have the cultural aspects of it. There was a time when this project first started where de Blasio was rezoning parts of the city to gentrify them and throwing this 30% like a bone to the dogs, where the dogs were asked to use the separate entrance in some of these buildings. They were let into these buildings and asked not to use the pool, that you have no access to the fit. He was creating, in a sense, a tale of two cities, which is ironic because his campaign ran on the promise to end the tale of two cities. And as it hits its twilight, as his pathetic presidential run has fizzled out, as the NYPD has both arrested and doxxed his own daughter and he hasn't had the courage to stand up to them, he's showing in many ways fundamentally that you don't trust the promises of a politician, no matter how revolutionary they say they are, no matter how progressive they say they are. You have to build mechanisms of accountability to say, okay, well, are you subject to recall, for example, if these campaign promises you've put forward don't go through? How can we hold you accountable? How do we know that what you say is going to be the truth? Like, should we trust you because you're progressive, because you're a socialist? Right? Like, and I think this is one of the shortfalls of the Democratic Socialists of America. And there's ways in which it's come back to bite us. I think like Cynthia Nixon's campaign for governor a few years ago is a good example, where no one bothered to clarify with Cynthia Nixon whether she was for or against the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to boycott Israeli goods in support of the struggle in Palestine for justice and reclaiming their land. And just prior to that, DSA had made waves in transforming itself from this old organization into this new thing, fueled by the energy of these thousands of young people who joined, tens of thousands, really, and had endorsed BDS, right? Yeah. And here we are in one of the most important states in the country endorsing a political candidate for office. And we haven't checked in on this question. And what happened is that Governor Cuomo, in his conservative, anti-Semitic, racist ways, him and his political friends decided they were going to send out a mailer accusing Cynthia Nixon of supporting the BDS movement. And up strolls Cynthia Nixon to a lectern one day to address these horrific thing, this race, Jewish racial baiting that Cuomo is doing. She said, you know what? This is despicable. Please know that I support people's right to support the BDS movement, but I myself do not support it. And if we'd done that necessary work, we wouldn't have been caught out in that situation, right? Mm. Like, if we'd done the work with AOC, we wouldn't have to be putting out statements when she herself endorsed Governor Cuomo. Mm. And I think as this political moment crystallizes, the main question you have to broach with any politician is the question of austerity. we know there's a disproportionately racist impact to austerity. There's also a way in which it goes against Native Americans and women and immigrants. But it's also a class-wide issue, right? It affects everyone, even the middle class, who themselves are struggling to hang on. Certain cuts will affect them. We, for example, in New York City, they've already begun laying off adjunct professors from the city's university system, telling them, we don't have the funds for you to come back next year. They've told us to make cuts. So any politician who puts themselves ahead of a movement needs to be asked, do you oppose any and all austerity? And in the same way, Grover Norquist had Tea Party, had a Republican political candidates take a tax pledge to not raise taxes to get the support of the Tea Party. We, the socialists, need to put forward an anti-austerity pledge, right? To then say that if you're going to go into office and you're going to represent us, then you must understand you can't participate in any cuts to the budget because it will literally kill people. And if you're not taking that pledge, then I'm questioning your commitment to the movement, and every thinking person should as well. And this I'm sorry, just to add, and this is not like a New York City specific thing, not a USA specific thing. In an era, right, of a rising authoritarianism, where Trump is the president of the United States, where Modi is the president of India, where we have Viktor Orban in Hungary, where we have right-wing populists tilting towards just taking over the state and staying there as long as they can, it is important that the people who are pledging to fight against them be held accountable, and that we be clear. Otherwise, we risk the danger, not just the co-option of our movement, but repression against it, because we would have built no defenses instead of putting all of our eggs in the one basket of the progressive politician.
Well, gosh, that's a lot to chew on. So, you know, as we were talking, I wrote down like six more questions. And so, you know, I'd love to talk with you again. But it's been great. I'm so glad, you know, you could make the time in what obviously is a really, you know, packed time for you. Well, good luck, comrade. I'm going to be looking for reports on July 4th. I'll keep my eyes out for...
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, comrade. It's been a really good opportunity for me to actually take a step back and relax from all the hectic activity and actually, you know, reflect and analyze on the things that have happened. Like, I think next to writing, having these, like, iron conversations with comrades is the next best thing to developing your analysis.
I agree, and it's part of why, you know, I decided to do this is sort of selfishly to just make sure that I was making the time. You know, the day-to-day work is the day-to-day work, and and I decided that this was a really good way to first of all get to know more of my comrades, but also just take the time to process and talk and, you know, identify the important questions.
I really love that, because, like, I think discussion and debate is one of our weak points, and we need as much infrastructure for it. So, like, the DSA national call on fighting racism under COVID-19, we'd called it the fire this time we can't breathe. That happened Friday night, and it had hundreds of people tuned in. I actually was not scheduled to be on it, but someone pulled out, so I filled in for them. But, like, we had real meaningful debate, you know, in that space, the same way we're having, like, an airing of the things that have made us happy and sad about DSA here. Yeah. And, you know, we finally got to discuss things like Adolf Reed in a public forum. We got to talk about whether militancy or pacifism was the best way for protests to go forward. We got to link to really live struggles happening, like Datrion Wilkins, who's an organizer for the New Orleans sanitation workers who are currently on strike, who have been replaced with prison labor. Like, she gave a fire presentation. pushing back against various things. So like we're getting there, and it's like a great time to be here. It's really and truly what a time to be alive.
Well said. Well, what a great note to close out. And I really look forward to talking with you again and seeing you on, you know, another call, you know, with AfroSoc or in some other capacity.
Yeah, looking forward to it, comrade. Please be well and safe.
Thank you. You as well, Robert. As mentioned at the top of this part, the New York Police Department is an especially formidable opponent. It will fight long, hard, and dirty. Substantial, lasting victories against it may therefore require years of the kind of hard work that movement organizers have already put in. And for the same reason, though, such victories will reverberate across the country and maybe even beyond. In addition to the importance of understanding the specific conditions in each site of struggle, this conversation raised some general issues I want to pursue further. A principal one is the old debate in the US left between the what's sometimes called the class first perspective versus the, let's call it, the race as the cutting edge of class in the US context way of looking at things. Next week, Cedric Johnson will offer us a notably different take on this than Cuffy does, also in the context of policing. I'll also continue to pursue the question of defunding or abolition as a transitional demand, as Cuffy describes it. And later this month, Doug McAdam, a leading scholar of US social movements, will tell us why this one is truly different. Join us in thinking aloud about how our day-to-day work during Corona can cohere into a battle plan for democratic socialism after it.